Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Matt Roller, who is the creator, showrunner, executive producer, I'm sure you have many titles, many official titles, for the new Netflix show that's debuting today, Haunted Hotel, adult animation. It's a huge, huge market. Everybody loves adult animation. But not that adult. It's TV 14. It's not, you know.
That was actually a battle we fought. We started TVMA and we wanted to be TV 14 because we thought it was more inclusive and more representative of what we were doing, you know?
Yeah. Well, we can talk about that in a second because it is interesting how these rating systems work for the streaming channels. But let's introduce folks to the show. So what is Haunted Hotel? What's the elevator pitch on Haunted Hotel, where you're trying to get people to watch a show? What do you tell them?
I would say Haunted Hotel is a comedy about horror. It's about a family that is trying to run a haunted, but also possessed and cursed and monster filled and cult occupied, whatever we really want, week to week. And also unsuccessful hotel. It's kind of a tribute to the horror genre, but I tell everyone you don't need to know anything about horror to like it or to understand it. And I would place it tonally somewhere between Rick and Morty, but less nihilistic, and Bob's Burgers, but more monsters. That's kind of what we were aiming for.
Okay, that's fair. That's a nice little mix there. You worked on Rick and Morty for a season, right?
I did, yeah. About 10 years ago, I think, season 2.
Okay. And Dan Harmon, who is the creator of that show, is an executive producer on this one, right?
Yes, Chris McKenna, who was with us on Community as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you worked on Community as well. I think this is a useful way to get people help people understand the tone of the show and what you're going for here. We're talking about a show that has the heritage of Rick and Morty and Community. I think you also worked on Krapopolis, right?
I worked on Krapopolis. Archer, Goldbergs, Archer. Speechless. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a good primer here. If you're into those shows, this is a good one for you. Like, I'm going to be honest, the thing that jumped out at me when our mutual friend Chris McKenna mentioned the show to me was Will Forte. I was like, yeah. I will listen. I love Will Forte. Will Forte, one of my favorites. I'll listen to him do anything. He is playing. Can we say so?
Yeah, that's not a spoiler. Comes out in the cold open. I think that's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, because it's funny. There's in the trailer for the, you know, there's a trailer for the show, and I watched it. And I was like, oh, this looks like fun. I watched the first episode. I've seen them all now. So I've seen the whole first season. Everyone should watch the whole first season because that's how Netflix decides if there will be a season 2.
That's right.
You start watching. Don't stop watching. Keep going.
Yeah,
keep going.
It's important to finish. And it's also important, little side note, they really look at that double thumbs up rating, which I had forgotten was still even there. And the double thumbs up matters. A single thumbs up is apparently almost worse than not rating it at all. Because I guess that means maybe you thought it was fine. But yeah, they really chase that double thumbs up, which again, people don't seem to really do that much.
Yeah. Interesting. I did not know that at all. That's a good thing. That's a good thing to know. But I got sidetracked here. Will Forte is playing the uncle of this family, of the hotel that the family moves into. And he is a ghost. He is a ghost in the hotel. I was surprised. I was actually surprised watching the first episode.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Watching it. So it was not apparent, but it's an amusing little tweak here. So this family moves into the hotel to kind of take it over, turn it around, live there. And they run into all sorts of stuff. When you were sitting down to sketch out, like, what the events in the hotel would look like, I'm curious what you guys had planned on trying to show episode to episode, right? Because there are a lot of different ways you can go with ghosts and murders and, you know, horror and everything. Like, did you have a specific idea? All right, this is going to be the slasher episode. This is going to be the cult episode. Like, what was your plan there?
Well, there's kind of two answers to that question. One is kind of the macro prep, question, how we built the world. And two is like, once we did what we did, once we were in season, and in terms of construction, the world, it sounds mercenary, but like, you know, I started the idea for this show with like, what would be a show world that would allow me to like explore the horror genre in the widest way possible? Like, I didn't want any doors closed to me. You know, when you write a movie or something like that, usually like there's a story you want to tell, but I think maybe specifically in episodic comedy, what you're starting with more is like a world where you can tell a lot of stories. That's kind of the goal. That would be success. So that's how I came around to like this hotel as a venue, because unlike a house, like it's full of a lot more rooms and you can always add more rooms, you know, season five or six, if you want, you know, there's always another corner that maybe we didn't show yet. And then build, you know, family into that as another kind of lowest common denominator of horror, something that like a lot of different horror movies have. And it would be nice to have those kind of archetypes in the show. And so at that point, once we kind of had the DNA that felt like, okay, this is a show that could do zombies, it could do possession, it could just do the ghosts, which in our show are mostly just like backdrop, kind of a Greek chorus for whatever else is going on. We got into season one writing, and that's where, to your point about like do a slasher episode, we started thinking about what is emotionally on the table with these characters and what is the low-hanging horror fruit. And ideally, episodes needed to address both of those. It wasn't so much just like, we're going to do a crazy slasher episode. There needed to be a little something more to it, to root it in kind of family drama and the emotion of it all, so that like it always had both. You know, it wasn't just parody. I would say that's not something we're doing. We're not spoofing horror. I think we're trying to embrace it earnestly. We're not undercutting like, here's a goofy idea of a slasher. I think in the slasher episode, it really is a murderer who is there to kill people, and our family are dealing with it the best they can. And the challenge in a comedy is how you address that without actually killing people.
You don't want to lose. Well, if they die though, they can stay on the hotel. You know, that's
true. They're locked in.
That does come up.
Yeah.
That does come up in one episode.
It does. Yeah.
It's a funny one. All right. The idea of doing a kind of a parody, but also having it be earnest, feels like something that is borrowed from or is used to great effect in Community, right? That is kind mm-hmm. of the idea of Community. Like, okay, we're kind of riffing on these things, but we do actually love them, and also we love these characters.
Yeah. I think early on, Dan Harmon would say, like, you know, the Chicken Fingers episode, which was a Goodfellas spoof, was an early point when the show kind of clicked. And I wasn't on the show at that point, but I thought that was just, yeah, it was great. And it was very much Goodfellas, and it wasn't really making fun of Goodfellas. It was just leaning into like the genre tropes of it within the world of that show. And that's what I think we're always trying to do as well. If I were to, you know, add to my elevator pitch of what the show is, I think there's an earnestness to it. I think a lot of comedy in the past 10 years, I'm super generalizing here, but has like kind of leaned into irony and kind of a meta wink at the viewer and like telling the viewer, like, we know what we're doing, to undercut that thing. And that's been successful and people like it. But going into this, I was ready to do something that was more specific to kind of my interests and sensibility. And that was earnestness. Like, we're not going to like wink at you that we're doing a slasher. We're just doing a slasher, or we're just doing a cult, or we're just doing, you know, there's a zombie in the hotel. Mm-hmm. All these things sound so broad when you just say the one sentence version, but so that was kind of our target.
Yeah, earnestness is looking back at your own kind of references and points of the things you liked growing up, the things you were watching growing up, the things you enjoy now. How would you describe? What is similar in tone? Like what nails that kind of earnest tone of what this show is, I think, successfully going for?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I wasn't allowed to watch a lot of TV growing up. Well, you know, it was more like, you know, you get a half hour a day, you get an hour a day, sure, just because sure. you should go do other stuff. And so, you know, in elementary, middle school, we burned our half hour on Full House. I didn't get to watch a lot of the, like, you know, bigger cultural touchstones of the 90s until I was like in college, because it wasn't part of my family's life growing up. So I think a lot of the earnestness might come more from just my own personal experience and aspirations about the type of world I want to live in. Something my wife recently called out is that there's a lot of comedy in my work, including this, where the joke is that someone is being vulnerable. And I'll offer by way of example, Ben, the son on the show, played by Skylar Gisondo, who's kind of just a dorky, earnest guy who just wants to make sure everyone's doing okay, including the ghost that is chasing him. There's a line where he's like trying to confide in someone that like he's having issues at school because his bully's parents are going through a divorce right now, and bullying Ben is the only thing that makes him feel normal. And the fact that Ben cares about that, I think, is just a great snapshot of a character, and just reveals, like, you know, the way he sees the world and feels about things. And to circle back to my point, my wife pointed out the fact that I think people being vulnerable is funny says something about maybe I wasn't allowed to be vulnerable growing up. It wasn't really part of, you know, the way my family operated. We all love each other, but I think there wasn't a lot of like sharing per se. It was a little more buttoned up. And so I think if I'm therapizing, that might be something I'm exploring now that I both find funny and wish to live in a world of.
That is funny. That is funny. He is maybe my favorite character on the show, Ben, who is voiced by Skylar Gisondo, who folks will remember from, he's in the new Superman movies, Jimmy Olsen. He's in on the Righteous Gemstones. Great.
Yep.
Great actor. But there's this wonderful episode where he goes into a cabinet and starts his kind of personality starts splitting off into mm-hmm. component parts. And the humor in that episode comes from not only the exaggerated notion of the characters. I mean, you know, I don't know how many other TV shows are going to have an episode with a character named Horny Ben. This one does. It's very funny. But also the way he kind of comes to feel sad about how everybody seems to like the component parts of him more than himself, which is it is a pretty kind of profound idea of what it means to not be comfortable in your own skin, which is really interesting.
Totally. And that's exactly what we were going for. We really liked, I mean, there's such a fun game on the table when you have like six versions of a character who all basically have an adjective to define them. And you can play that adjective, you know, in the scene, in every response they give. And that was the fun part. But the emotional part, yes, was that the prime version of this character is feeling on the outs next to the more defined versions of him that surround him. And ultimately, they are all cutting him out. And I just thought that said something really interesting about, you know, the confidence of the character, and gives him a fun hill to climb to get back out of it by the end of the episode.
Yeah. Let's walk through the process of getting this show kind of conceived and pitched and made, because it is an incredibly long process. For any show, really, but I feel like animated shows are even longer. I feel like the process of getting this thing made has been going on for years now. I mean, this is all right. So let's start at the beginning. You come up with the idea for it. What is the month and year that you go to your friends and you say, I want to make a show about a haunted hotel?
Well, this show had a particularly long haul for it's hard to even call it development phase, because it wasn't always even like with a studio, but I went back and looked, and the first draft I have of this is from January 2015.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. So the journey to Netflix was, I came up with the idea for this show around the time I was on season two of Rick and Morty. And so you can date when that is. I don't think I started writing until after Rick and Morty was over. But the show as a script pretty quickly sold to Universal, who promptly put it in a drawer. And I truly don't even remember like how it played out, what happened. At the time, I think I was a story editor, so they would have had to attach a showrunner anyway, because that's like the it's the sophomore essentially of writers. So you've been doing it for like 1 year and now you're in your second one. So it didn't really go anywhere. But after 3 years, the rights reverted to me. And I brought it to Dan Harmon and Chris McKenna, and we sold it to FX under Dan's deal. And we developed it there for a year, just kind of kicking the tires on what it could be. We yanked out a dad character who we thought was kind of stealing focus from Nathan, the brother, because that's really the core duo, Catherine, the sister, and Nathan, the ghost brother. And at the end of that year, FX passed. And then another three-ish years after that, we landed at Netflix. Again, once the rights kind of reverted back. And at that point, that's what I would call the beginning of the somewhat normal development and production cycle that brought us to series. And so you could say that started around May or June of 2023. I think we sold it in May of 2023. And a lot of shows at that point in animation, you know, it varies for every show, but they might want to see another script for proof of concept. They might want to see some art first, understand what it's going to look like. For our part, the trees just kind of started moving and never stopped. In a really great, lucky, and thank you Netflix kind of way, no one ever said, like, well, let's see what the pilot looks like and then we'll order another nine. We just kept on doing the next step, and no one said stop. So what happened in June 2023, two things started working in tandem. One, we had the script, and we needed to start casting it and recording it. And two, we needed to start figuring out what the show looked like. So the record side was somewhat simpler. That was just kind of a standard, same you do in live action. You know, you're auditioning actors, you have people read for it, you cast it, and then you start recording them individually on our show in the booth. And once you have all the records, you cut together into a radio play, and there you go. You have a version of, like, if you closed your eyes and watched the pilot, that's essentially what that was, minus music and sound effects. The visual development side, that second component, is quite a bit more involved. And when a show is starting out, I think scary, because you're trying to figure out both what the show should look like and also what your characters should look like within that style. Mm-hmm. You know, because the first thing is like, well, The Simpsons has a style and Bob's Burgers has a style and Rick and Morty has a style. And honestly, a lot of adult animation falls into a somewhat similar style. There are some shows that like feel like they could share a universe. And you have to figure out like, well, where do we exist within that? Do we want to feel like we're part of another show's universe? Ideally, no. And then within that, okay, we've kind of locked down our style. What do our characters look like? And those processes kind of happen in tandem. You just bring in a bunch of artists and you have them take a pass at Nathan, the ghost brother played by Will Forte. And you get across all these artists, like 50 versions of what Nathan could be. And you start with like representations of like, I kind of think he feels like this guy. I think he would wear this. I think this is his energy. And you start evaluating those 50 versions, which would be in very different styles. Some very broad, some might feel a little more kid oriented. But as you go, you start to recognize like, oh, that looks like Nathan. Or more interestingly, that looks like the style of our show, but that doesn't look like Nathan. So the way you're drawing the eyes and the way you're proportioning the arms, I think our character should feel like that. But I think Nathan should look more like this character over here, like option 20 in the style of option 7. And you just do that over and over again for like, you know, 4 or 5 months to dial in both what the characters look like and what the world looks like. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm talking for a long time about
that. You
should
keep talking. Keep going.
Well, so the interesting challenge there, in terms of the style of the show, because I'm seeing praise and criticism online now about, like, you know, the show's style looks familiar. It looks great. And I will say, for our part, there were two things I was considering in terms of the style of the show, specifically the characters. The background, the world was a little different. For better or worse, I think a lot of adult animation, Western adult animation right now, looks somewhat similar, sometimes to a fault. And you could kind of step out of that. But I think part of the problem is, like, it's what the average audience, not the online audience, but the average audience has been trained to understand, oh, this is for adults. And if you go too far outside of that, again, I don't think it's necessarily a good thing. I think you lose audience. Second to that, and a creative reason that we wanted to be a little closer to, like, you know, accurate proportions of characters and similar to what's out there, where we decided we wanted to do our kind of visual pushing exploration was in leaning into horror as a genre. And for that, what we wanted was leads who looked fairly grounded. We wanted them to be relatable, kind of look like us, so that we could surround them with things that were more pushed and monstrous. And if they already looked a little bit wacky or, you know, had kind of elastic proportions, the contrast wouldn't be as clear. So that was kind of a creative reason to do that. And then on the show background side, this is where I think our artist did great work, kind of led by Robbie Irwin, who is our art director. We spend so much time in this hotel, as opposed to Rick and Morty, which is in a multiverse, and every episode they can go to a different planet and it can look totally different. We're living in this hotel. And so I think there's fun in that, but you also, you need the hotel to look good. You need it to look interesting. So drawing inspiration from a lot of old New England hotels, like, we really wanted it to feel visceral and lived in. So paying attention to the floorboards and to different wallpaper in all the rooms that, like, doesn't necessarily match and is peeling, and art on the walls. And we threw in a lot of Easter eggs as well, because you have to populate a hotel with, you know, wall art and furniture. And as we were doing so, you know, we were thinking, well, if we got to put a couch here, why not put this couch from this horror movie? And maybe the fans will catch it, maybe they won't. But either way, it adds specificity and, you know, hopefully makes someone make a YouTube about it. So that got us a show world. And that process extended through the beginning of the writer's room, which created its own interesting challenge, because we started writing the 10 episodes of season one while we still didn't fully know what the show looked like. And that creates a situation where you sometimes have to go back, you know, sometimes little things where we would call it the parlor versus the office. And then we saw how the office was designed and we liked it and realized, like, oh, that action can't happen in the office. There's no windows and it's too small. Just like little logistical things that wouldn't come up in live action, because you would build the sets based on your needs. And here everything's happening in tandem. But eventually, around episode 5 or 6, we were in a place where, like, okay, everything's pretty clearly designed, at least on a level like where we know where the windows and doors are and rooms are and what all our characters look like. And we have a rough idea of how they emote. And that's where things really started, I think, to click, where I like the intro episodes. I think there's a clear shift as the series goes on, as we find it. And that's just the nature of production of animation. We finally had all the components and we knew how to use them. And that process kind of takes us through storyboards, which is like the black and white version of the show. And then the writers, except for me, are all gone, because, you know, the episodes are wrapped. And a little while after that, we get the animation back, which is done by a separate studio, Titmouse Vancouver, in our case. And then the process kind of creatively begins all over again, because, you know, what I saw up to that point was the black and white sort of flipbook version, not even, because it's not as detailed as a flipbook, with temp sound effects and voice work in there, but, you know, not really mixed properly yet. That comes later. And suddenly you get back an animated version and the characters are fully moving in a fluid way. And you have to wrap your head around, like, is it fluid in a way that I like? Am I just not used to it? Because there are so many choices still to make. And, you know, the way these characters move their bodies and how much they move their bodies. So it's just constant choices. But at that point, you're getting near the finish line.
Yeah. Well, let me stop and ask a couple of separate questions here. The first is about the actual process of animation, because I have simultaneously kind of an old fashioned view of animation, which is like the Simpsons script gets sent to Korea and somebody draws it and then they send it back, which I don't think they do anymore. But like, that's kind of like the one way of doing it. And then I have like the South Park notion, right? Which is that like those guys sit down and they do it in 6 days. Once every 2 weeks now.
Yes.
But then there's the kind of Rick and Morty style, which is different. And I don't know much about it. And I'm curious, like what the actual process is. So do you get, they do some animation, they send it back to you and you say, okay, no, I want them to move like this, or I want the scene to be from this perspective instead of this perspective.
Yes.
Like how much can you monkey with things after they do a draft?
You can monkey with anything you want, but it will cost time and money. And if you're doing your job well, there's less and less to monkey with at each step. But it's an incredibly iterative process where early on you can blow anything up, and you really just have to be thinking about what it's going to look like down the road. So where it starts, and we are closer to the Simpsons version, but there's basically kind of our front-end studio, which in our case is also Titmouse, but here in Los Angeles. And they're the ones doing the storyboards. So once we have a radio play, which is, you know, the timed, it's probably going to be 23 minutes because we aggressively tried to stick to kind of network standards just for comedy pacing. You have the timed version of what it's going to sound like, at least from a character perspective. And now people are going to go off and board that. And what that looks like very specifically is there will be a black and white sketch for basically every meaningful movement in the episode. So every time someone raises their hand because they have to gesture to something or changes their expression, we'll have a board for that. Leading into that process, I'll have a sit down with our supervising director, Erica Hayes, who is also on Rick and Morty, the director of the episode, and sometimes the board artist, and talk about kind of the intent of every scene, which is very similar to kind of a pre-production meeting in live action, except we don't, you know, have cameras per se. We're drawing the cameras. And I'll just try to sell like the point of every scene. And especially in this, a horror comedy, it's important to distinguish like this scene is just comedy and this scene is horror. And a lot of times that's obvious, but sometimes there's nuance to it. Sometimes the scene is meant to evoke tension. You know, we want to live in the single pushing in on this character to show their kind of isolation and loneliness, because the intent on the back end is going to be to drop in some kind of creepy foreboding music as they realize, et cetera, et cetera. So the board artist will go off with that. And what they do first is a rough version of boards. And that's the version where basically all you're looking at is the shot choice and the blocking within it. And the characters will basically be stick figures, maybe with like a smiley face or a sad face to kind of like bookmark this is how they're feeling in the moment for the next pass. And it's kind of the best stage to blow things up, because it's the first time you're seeing the thing on its feet. And the director is definitely making independent creative choices about like how to shoot, how to draw this action sequence, this horror sequence. And when you get it back to my sensibility and to the supervising director's sensibility, it might not be what we were thinking of. And it, you know, it might be worse is a bad term to use, but like it's different or it's not evoking what we needed to. So we talk it through, and the next version, again, roughs, is usually way more specific. And, you know, half the shots might now be different because we talked about it. We got into the specifics and now we're getting a lot closer. At that point, it starts to become safe to spend board artist time drawing the details, making the next set of choices, having the characters emote and gesture and pick up things and interact with each other in a clearer way than stick figures would. And that results in a new round of notes, because now you're evaluating their expressions. And even though it's just like, you know, a storyboard and a black and white version, the animators up in Vancouver are going to religiously pay attention to that expression. So that expression needs to be right. If the expression looks dismayed instead of aghast, you know, it's just, it's the difference of an eyebrow, but someone's going to spend a lot of time animating it, and it takes a lot of work. And if you don't get that eyebrow right, you're wasting potentially hours. Eyebrow, it's dramatic, but the scenario holds, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So you want to, ultimately, by the time you're done and you have the clean version of storyboards that get shipped up for animation, my personal notes, which are basically in an Excel doc where I note, like, you know, the specific board I'm talking about and what the issue is and the suggested fix, my notes for each episode went down to around 5,000 lines, usually something around that for each episode. That goes up to be animated. And that whole process, by the way, and there's a ladder because you have three directors working at once on episode 1, 2, 3, and then director one goes over to episode 4, 5, 6. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I believe the process for that storyboarding, it might be like 2 months, something like that. The first version takes the longest. They get the longest time to kind of start, and then it's just about fixing it. And then get shipped up for full animation. And at that point, outside of, we saw an early teaser of the cold open just to make sure we're all on the same page about how this should move and look in general. But for an average episode, you kind of don't see it for like 6 months, something like that. And then it comes back down as a whole piece. And for our show in particular, sometimes there were effects that were not done yet. There's an episode where the hotel fills with demonic smoke, and they had not animated the smoke yet because that's a whole other thing. But, you know, we could see where it was going to be enough to note it. And then basically you do the same process again. Now, at this stage, if you did your job right, because this animation takes a lot more work than boarding, you're not going to say, well, we don't like this shot, we don't like this blocking, because theoretically you sent them off with the right shot and blocking. And as long as they held to it, you usually want to like stick to it, unless like creatively you realize like, we messed up, this doesn't work. But that's not the thing you want to go to, because it puts you behind schedule, it's very expensive. So usually what you're doing at this stage, if you've been rigorous and made good choices, is you're again kind of tweaking expressions and trying to plus things. Because what I'm not noting in this process is that there is a lot of discovery. You know, I spend a lot of time dictating what I think it should be, but then these artists go beyond that. You know, they interpret the note and they plus it and they add things we didn't think about. A detail I'm remembering is, again, in that episode that has a lot of ghosts in the hotel, there's a point where Catherine says, Abaddon's a demon, this little demon boy in the hotel. And he turns around and says, you remembered. And he has his fingers in just this weird little delighted pose. And we didn't note that. That was just some animator who liked Abaddon, thought like he should have this funny little finger pose. And I think it's going to be a gif, you know? It's very funny and memorable and specific. So that's the push-pull of this all, trying to get what's in your head that sells the story and doesn't misrepresent it, and also allowing for all these happy discoveries and also not blowing things up.
No, not blowing things up is good. You don't want to have to. There are two things you've said here. One just now, that's going to be a gif. And earlier, about a little Easter egg, hopefully somebody makes a YouTube video about it. And this is, you know, look, this is the curse of the showrunner, right? Is that it's not just, you're not just thinking about the show that you have to make. You're thinking about the show that you have to sell. And not just to Netflix, not to Universal or whoever. You have to sell it to the audience and hope that they seize on things in their own way. And I'm curious, A, what you make of the kind of current state of TV viewing, TV fandom. What do you make of the people broadly? But like,
For sure.
On top of that, like, do you think about this sort of thing as you are making the show, as you are animating it? Was there ever a time where we need to do something here to like really make this pop?
It's a complicated question. I will say in the short term, you're hearing a lot of YouTube and GIF from me right now on Tuesday before the show comes out, because I am very mindful we are about to drop and I'm in a marketing mode. I would say in general, when we are making the show, I am never chasing, you know, what is going to pop online. I'm not thinking about like, we need to have Abaddon do the Wednesday dance, you know? Mm-hmm. I am thinking about what would be fun, because I would say specific to this show, because I enjoy this, like, I am trying to make a popular product, you know, that I enjoy this animation, and I'm trying to make something that is a fun watch that, there's a term coming up a lot, that I was not aware of, but I'm seeing it in the negative reactions where people are like, oh great, more blank slop, more adult animation slop. And they use it to refer to a lot of shows that I won't say. So we're not trying to make slop, you know, we're not just trying to phone it in. We spent years on this, but we are trying to make something fun. So that's kind of the push pull. I'm not trying to make something that is so specific to a personal vision that, it could not be relatable to people or alienate people. Like, at the end of the day, I am trying to make a little bit of an amusement park ride, like a clever one that you haven't seen before, but something that, like, you want to watch again and you have fun with. No one has ever pushed me to, like, make it more popular or more, you know, specific to what they think people will like. To your question about the fandom, I think people get very obsessed with what they like, probably more than they need to. I've noticed, you know, specifically this week, I'm very online. People are
this is
very
a mistake. You got to log off, man. That's,
I know I do. Well, here's the thing.
Drive yourself crazy.
I'm not engaging with negativity. But I would like to read the negativity. People are very defensive of the shows they already like and assume the new thing coming in cannot possibly do what the show they like does. And I know, of course, once it comes out, once any new show comes out, it finds its own fandom. So that's simply not true. I think people just like to be angry online. And yeah, it's a big, like, you know, log off and touch grass situation.
No, I look, I should practice what I preach, myself.
If everyone, who is commenting on this show on YouTube and TikTok and Instagram knew that the creator absolutely has read their comment, I have read all of the comments. part of it is that I have, a 9-week-old. And so I'm spending a lot of time, you know, in a dark room holding this baby to sleep, and phone is in the other hand, you know. What else am I going to do?
That's a familiar, another familiar situation. So I feel you. All right. So you read all the comments. You're going to drive yourself crazy. That's okay.
It's fine.
Speaking of driving yourself crazy, the hotel itself is what you were saying about the kind of layout of the hotel and where you wanted certain things is very interesting. Did you have a full architectural schematic of the hotel? Like, how did that actually work? Because, like you say, if you're making a movie or a TV show, you want it in a room, you just build the room. Like, here's the office, here's the ballroom, here's, you know, and it's very, side note here, there's a very funny segment of fans of The Shining who have mapped out like how the
hotel the 237, the impossible hallways, and there can't be a window there, and I love it.
Exactly And it's a very there are obsessives like that, which kind of again leads to my question here. How did you plan this, or did you not? Was it just like we wrote it and then we tried to make it all work?
No, we did try to plan it. I will say, we can't play that room 237. Like, we can't play that impossible window game because it just looks like a mistake in animation. You know, it looks like we didn't think about it. So going into it, I had kind of deliberate ideas about the design of the hotel and the scale I wanted to be realistic for a family to run it. It couldn't be like some, you know, 200 room place like the original Overlook. The Stanley Hotel, I think, because like, how are they running this thing? And I also didn't want like a 5-room bed and breakfast because it didn't feel like the scope that would allow for, you know, a mystery around every corner. Mm-hmm. So that kind of was the starting sensibility that helped us dial in. And once we had our layout, which was its own very iterative process, we started thinking about the spaces within the building. And there was a push-pull there between wanting to allow for anything and wanting to play to the tropes of horror. And something I thought about when we were doing it, and this happens a lot in horror, but at the time I was thinking of The Conjuring, where there's an early tracking shot when the family moves into their old farmhouse, where you follow them as they're moving in, and you go into the living room, and you go upstairs into the bedrooms. And it's just, it's a nice, fun, energetic shot that serves the additional purpose of letting you know the layout of the space, so that later on in Act Two, when, you know, you're downstairs and there's a scary thump upstairs, you know, that's the girl's room, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to the horror to have that sort of context. And I wanted that for this show. And I honestly still don't know if you can do that in animation, if people retain the same sense of space in animation that like works in live action horror. So I at least wanted to know where spaces were in relation to one another. If we're in the lobby and we go to the ballroom, I want to know, well, is it upstairs? Is it which hallway is it down? Because I want to go that way every time. I don't want to make it up. I want to know which hallways take us there. So we were loyal to that with one or two random exceptions that just got away from us. But beyond that, I also didn't want to so clearly define a floor plan that we couldn't invent new rooms or spaces down the road. You know, like if we want to throw a pool in for something, I didn't want to, you know, so clearly define the hotel that like, well, where'd that pool come from? That doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be conceivable that like, you just haven't seen the pool yet. And it comes up very early in the pilot in the town hall. Catherine holds up a floor plan of the hotel. And you might notice it's intentionally not very good. It's kind of just like an outline with not a lot of sketches in the middle. And that was a combination of we did not have a floor plan, and also I did not want to make one for that reason. So it just kind of it landed in that place.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've animated the episodes. They're ready to go. All the finals are with Netflix. They've got everything. What's the process like? So when was everything done? Like when could somebody have hit the button at Netflix and published?
As I said, we started in like June of 2023. You could have basically hit the publish button end of July 2025.
Okay.
So
2 years. 2 years.
A little That's, over 2 years. Yeah. We did our final color correct, which is where you can kind of like, you know, plus the fire and shadows and vignette things and just, you know, just little color details, kind of what it sounds like in shorthand, in June. And at that point, it went to Netflix for quality control, which is mostly out of our hands. They're looking for like actual errors that were not caught by us. And those usually revert very quickly back to just the animation team for a fix, because it's not really a creative choice. It's just something that got messed up in production. And that took about a month. And then they were also doing subtitles, like all those little, like, you know, cross your T's, dot your I's situations. But yeah, by end of July, I think they might've still been doing a little bit of subtitle translation stuff, but it's just been there. And since then it's kind of been about marketing to the extent that we're doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you mentioned briefly that there was a fight between TVMA and TV14, which is kind of interesting, because I think, you know, I would think just as an outsider looking at it, like, all right, you're doing an adult animation thing. TVMA suggests TVMA is essentially the PG-13 of
it can be, yeah.
TV ratings now is kind of what it feels like. I mean, that's, you know, I think Rick and Morty's TVMA, right? I assume it must be.
Rick and Morty is TV-14.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So, okay. To be honest,
I would have thought TVMA, but no. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. In that case, there's no universe in which this is TVMA.
Exactly.
And Rick and Morty is TV-14. That's crazy.
So I think, you know, it's a somewhat subjective rating. And when we got back the TVMA, it's not a death sentence, but I do think you only limit yourself by having a higher rating, because I don't think adults are really looking at the rating. I do think parents are probably looking at it. And, you know, Rick and Morty and Bob's Burgers are TV-14. Big Mouth and South Park are TVMA. And I can see parents being in a situation where like, well, TVMA, or they have friends over, kids' friends over, TVMA, we're not watching that. So I thought that was a battle worth fighting. And what we actually had to do, because we were TVMA for reasons of gore, essentially, because mm-hmm. there's no swearing in the show. There's not really sexual situations. But, you know, there's dead bodies, and there is a moment where someone's throat gets cut. And they were pointing to those as like, those are very clear TVMA moments. And so what I did was I went back through, and this is Netflix's own rating division. I went back to other Netflix shows, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, Wednesday, and I found one-for-one examples of those same things happening in those two TV-14 shows. An example in Sabrina of a live-action character saying, "Praise Satan," I believe, and then cutting their own throat, full view of camera, just to demonstrate, you know, maybe the subjectivity or at least the sure. necessary for sure. equality in ratings. And we had to tweak a few little things, but we got it down, and, you know, we'll never know if it makes a difference, but I think it definitely couldn't hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm sure. I, you know, and look, people have their TV set up to block certain ratings. I'm sure they're
right.
That's an issue. So that's interesting. That's interesting. I had just always kind of assumed, Rick, I don't look at the ratings myself when I watch the show.
Sure.
I had always just,
you don't need to. You're over 14.
Because I'm an adult. I'm allowed. I can watch whatever I want. Well, that was everything. There was one more question I had to ask, which is the voice cast on this is amazing. And it's very funny because you get these great actors who show up for like literally 20 seconds or, you know, 30 seconds, like in the God, I forget which episode it is. I forget which numeral episode it is. But there's this mm-hmm. moment where Keith David shows up for like a voice of one character.
Well, the first one. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is that in the first one? Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's just like, "Hey, how's it going? All right." And then he's gone. He does. It's just like you must have between the work on Community and Rick and Morty and everything else, you must have a Rolodex of people that you can just be like, "Hey, you want to hop on? You want to hop in your recording booth for like 2 minutes for me and knock something out?"
That basically is what it is. It's us calling in to our connections, because yes, I'm surprised too at the people we get for a 30-second part. We had Jim Rash, also from Community, come in to play a dancing pumpkin who sings a song and that's it. And yeah, you have these people in to record for 5 minutes, literally. And then thanks. That's all we needed. But yeah, I think it pluses everything. I love all the voices on the show. So I would do it again.
Yeah. All right. No, it's again, it's just something to listen for as you're watching the show.
For sure.
To the viewers out there. There's a great cast here. All right. That was everything I wanted to ask. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. Do you think there's anything folks should know about the show or, you know, getting it made, getting it written? I'm sure there are things that I should have asked that I did not. What should folks know about?
I mean, this was a great interview, very comprehensive. I think the thing that I like to bookend with again is just that it's a comedy first, you know, it's about horror, but you don't need to know about horror to watch it. And I'm excited for people to understand the characters, get to know the characters, and also see if they can find all the Easter eggs, because there are about 90 in the season, which I know is not the point of this at all, but when you're going through it and you're animating the thing over the course of 2 years, and it's a case of like, well, we need another rug in this room, and, you know, well, we could do a generic rug, or we could take the wallpaper from the hallway in Hereditary and turn that design into a rug, which, again, will anyone notice? Who knows?
Oddly specific. So I think folks should be looking for a rug that looks like something they remember from Hereditary. I'm just going to... So 90 references, is that 90 individual movies or 90 maybe different things from some of the same movies?
90 different things from some of the same movies. I would put the movie count probably in the 50s, something like that, because there's a few things we go to multiple times. Something I'm very happy with is just like a little go the extra mile detail. We had to populate the hallways of the hotel with art, like many animated shows. You got to put something on the wall, And I think the standard go-to would be like a little landscape, you know, like there's a lake and a mountain, like whatever takes four lines to draw. And what we asked our animators to do, because we had a little bit of time to do it, was, you know, what if we did the simple versions of houses from horror movies? So if you look on the wall in the background of different shots in the hotel, you might see the Amityville Horror House, the Conjuring House, Michael Myers House. At one point when Abaddon is in a duel, the wall art behind him is of the truck and car from Spielberg's Duel. Not quite a horror movie, but, you know, we're
thriller.
We're having fun with it. Yeah, yeah, adjacent.
Tense thriller. I think that works.
You know. He was certainly horrified, the driver.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's fine. That counts. No, that's fun. You should... if somebody puts together a YouTube with all 90, they got to get a tour of the fictional set next time, you know?
Yeah. We'll get a t-shirt. We'll get them a photo with Abaddon.
Excellent. Excellent. Do you guys have, is there a Netflix merch for Haunted Hotel? Do you guys have a,
there's not,
t-shirts?
We have, you know, like a wrap gift. We did a skateboard deck that has like a real cool piece of like art with all the characters from the season on it. But Netflix doesn't really do merch until they see success. So, yeah. You know, we'll get into Hot Topic one of these days, but.
I'll tell you, as somebody with a 10-year-old daughter who has been looking for K-pop Demon Hunters gear, it's a real problem.
They
got to get that.
They had totally that specific problem, like in the Netflix store, they have stuff they can roll out with like a week's notice. And then everything else takes a lot longer. So we're not there yet.
All right. So, thank you, Matt, for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This is great.
And the name of the show again is Haunted Hotel. It's on Netflix right now. If you're listening to this, you are able to watch it on Netflix. So go to your streaming device of choice, turn it on, watch it all the way through, and hit the double thumbs up button.
That's it, so
we can get season two. Season two plans? Do you guys, are there, nobody wants there, to make there one are, season of TV.
Totally. There are aspirations. I'm very aware, again, reading all the comments, that I think the number one comment is, this looks great. Can't wait for Netflix to cancel it because, yeah, I think there's a kind of fair reputation that things get two seasons and then they're done. I know Netflix is aware of that reputation, at least Netflix Animation, and isn't thrilled with it. But I think it is still so number dependent. Like, people need to watch, and if people watch, we'll get to make more.
I deal with that as well. So it's, make sure you watch it and like, and, you know, click subscribe and like,
and you know what, double thumbs up everything you like,
double
not
thumbs
just
up all the things.
Double thumbs up everything. We should be using that because Netflix cares.
I gotta say, that's actually a shock to me. I should know that, actually. I should know that from my various interviews and stuff, but this is, I gotta actually get in there and start giving some thumbs up to stuff to get
an more. Underused feature. Yeah.
All right. Matt, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
All right. And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.